Welcome to today's reading of Newsmax on the Talking Information Center on this Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. I'm your volunteer reader, Dennis McDonald, and here are your headlines. DOJ issues new subpoenas in Russian election interference response. The Justice Department has issued new subpoenas in a Florida-based investigation targeting individuals who pursued actions against President Donald Trump, as well as examining the U.S. government's response to Russian interference in the 2016 election, according to multiple people familiar with the matter. In an initial wave of subpoenas in November, asked recipients for documents related to the preparation of a U.S. intelligence community assessment that detailed a sweeping multi-prong effort by Moscow to help Trump defeat Democrat nominee Hillary Clinton in 2016 election. Though the first subpoenas requested documents from the months surrounding the January 17th publication of the Obama administration's intelligence assessment, the latest subpoenas seek any records from the years since then, said the people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to the Associated Press to discuss a non-public demand from investigators. The Justice Department declined to comment Tuesday. The subpoenas represent continued investigative activity in one of several criminal inquiries the Justice Department has undertaken into Trump's political opponents. An array of former intelligence and law enforcement officials have received subpoenas and lawyers for former CIA Director John Brennan, who helped oversee the drafting of the assessment, have said they have been informed he is a target, but have not been told of any legally justifiable basis for undertaking this investigation. The intelligence community assessment, published in the final days of the Obama administration, found that Russia had developed a clear preference for Trump in the 2016 election and that Russian President Vladimir Putin had ordered an influence campaign with goals of undermining confidence in the American democracy and harming Clinton's chance for victory. That conclusion and a related investigation into whether the 2016 Trump campaign colluded with Russia to sway the outcome of the election have long been among the Republican president's chief grievances, and he has vowed retribution against the government officials involved in the inquiries. Former FBI Director James Comey was indicted by the Trump administration's Justice Department last year on a false statement and obstruction charges, but the case was later dismissed. Multiple government reports, including bipartisan congressional reviews and a criminal investigation by former special counsel Robert Mueller, have found that the Russian interfered in Trump's favor through a hack and leak operation of Democrats' emails, as well as a covert social media campaign aimed at sowing discord and swaying American public opinion. Mueller's report found that the Trump campaign actively welcomed the Russian help, but it did not establish that Russian operatives and Trump or his associates conspired to tip the election in his favor. The Trump administration has freshly scrutinized the intelligence community assessment, in part because a classified version of it incorporated in its annex a summary of the Steele dossier, a complication of Democrat-funded opposition research that was assembled by former British spy Christopher Steele and was provided to the FBI. That research into Trump's potential links to Russia included uncorroborated rumors and salacious gossip, and Trump has long held up its weaknesses in an effort to discredit the entire Russia investigation. The investigation in Florida appears to be part of a broader administration effort to revisit years-old findings and decisions from the Russia investigation. A declassified CIA tradecraft review released last July by current director John Ratcliffe did not refute the conclusion of Russian election interference, but found multiple procedural anomalies in the intelligence community assessed and cheated Brennan for the fact that the classified version referenced the Steele dossier. Brennan testified to Congress and also wrote in his memoir that he was opposed to including information from the dossier in the intelligence assessment since neither its substance nor sources had been validated. And he has said the dossier did not inform the judgments of the assessment. He maintains the FBI pushed for its inclusion. The CIA review sought to cast Brennan's views in a different light, asserting that he showed a preference for narrative consistency over analytical soundness, and brushed aside concerns over the dossier because he believed it conformed with existing theories. It quotes him without context as having stated in writing that my bottom line is that I believe that the information warrants inclusion in the report. It is unclear whether the investigation in Florida will result in any criminal charges. In a letter last December addressed to the chief judge of the Southern District of Florida, Brennan's lawyers challenged the underpinning of the investigation, questioning what bias prosecutors had for opening the inquiry in the state and saying they had received no clarity from prosecutors about what potential crimes were even being investigated. While it is mystifying how the prosecutors could possibly believe there is any legally justifiable basis for undertaking this investigation, they have done nothing to explain that mystery. The lawyers wrote, describing the investigation as manufactured. Next we have Trump marks 5 years since Limbaugh's death by Mark Swanson. President Donald Trump on Tuesday honored conservative icon Rush Limbaugh on the 50th anniversary of his death, calling him a really great man and saying there will never be another Rush Limbaugh. In a video posted on Truth Social, Trump reflected on Limbaugh's impact on the conservative movement and his own political rise. This is the 50th anniversary of the loss of a really great man, a great conservative, somebody that loved our country. But he was a friend of mine, Rush Limbaugh, Trump said. Trump recalled that he had never met Limbaugh when he launched his 2016 presidential campaign, but was quickly told the influential broadcaster had offered his support. I had never met Rush when I announced I was running. I'll never forget 2015, Trump said. And I got a call, all excited, that Rush just endorsed you. I'd never met him. And he liked my opening speech. Trump said he later developed a personal friendship with Rush, with Limbaugh, and came to appreciate him beyond his public persona. When I got to know him, I realized what a great guy he was, he said. It's 5 years, and we miss Rush. There will never be another Rush Limbaugh. To his great wife and family, I just want to say, we miss you all. We miss him, and there'll never be anybody like him, Trump said. Limbaugh, who died February 17, 2021, at the age of 70 after a battle with lung cancer, was one of the most influential figures in modern conservative politics. His nationally syndicated radio program The Rush Limbaugh Show dominated talk radio for decades, drawing millions of listeners and helping shape Republican grassroots activism. During Trump's presidency, Limbaugh was a vocal supporter and defender of the administration's policies. In 2020, Trump awarded Limbaugh the Presidential Medal of Freedom during the State of the Union address, praising him as a special man and a legend. Limbaugh's endorsement in the early days of the 2016 campaign was seen as a significant boost among conservative voters and talk radio audiences nationwide. Next, we have Newsmax's Rosen. Trump judicial pace slows after sterling first year. The administration's effort to reshape the federal judiciary, which set a brisk pace in President Donald Trump's first year back in office, appears to be slowing amid a growing number of vacancies. James Rosen, Newsmax chief Washington correspondent, reported Tuesday. Having confirmed 26 federal judges last year, the Republican-led Senate exceeded the pace set during the first year of President Trump's first term in office, Rosen said on American Agenda. Rosen added that aides to Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, told Newsmax that the panel held hearings for 96% of the judicial nominations that the administration sent up to the Hill last year, the highest percentage since 1980. But despite the early momentum, Rosen said committee staff told Newsmax it is incumbent on the White House and home state senators to keep the nomination machine churning. Citing data from the Article 3 Project, a conservative legal advocacy group, Rosen reported that there are 15 vacancies for federal district court judgeships in states where each party has one senator representing the state. More strikingly, he added, there are nearly two dozen vacancies for district court judgeships in eight states where both senators are Republican. Those states include Alabama, Alaska, Florida, Kansas, Louisiana, Ohio, Oklahoma, and Texas. Mike Davis, founder and president of the Article 3 Project and former chief counsel for nominations to Grassley, has played a role in confirming roughly 300 federal judges and three Supreme Court justices. In an interview with Newsmax, Davis pushed back on Chief Justice John Roberts' assertion that there are no Obama judges or Trump judges. Despite what the Chief Justice said, there is definitely a difference between a Republican judge who follows the law, and a Democrat judge who sabotages the will of the American people and disregards the law, Davis said. I have been turning up the heat, and it's working because I've heard from my friends inside the Trump administration that we've gotten these senators' attention, and they're finally coming to the table. Rosen reported Davis also noted that 62 of 93 U.S. attorney positions across the country also remain vacant, underscoring what conservative activists describe as unfinished business in staffing the federal courts and key law enforcement posts. Next, we have top DHS spokesperson to exit Trump administration by Jim Mishler. Trisha McLaughlin, a top spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security, is leaving the Trump administration, according to Politico, which cited two department sources. McLaughlin, who serves as spokesperson for DHS Secretary Kristi Noem, is expected to inform colleagues of her decision and will depart the agency next week. She has been one of the administration's most visible defenders of its immigration enforcement policies, frequently appearing in national media interviews and responding to critics online during high-profile operations in cities including Chicago and Minneapolis. McLaughlin, a former communications aide to Vivek Ramaswamy's 2024 presidential campaign and to Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, began planning her departure in December, but delayed it as the department responded to several major actions, according to the people familiar with her exit. The report indicated the sources spoke on the condition of anonymity. During her tenure, McLaughlin often appeared on news outlets including Newsmax, CNN, CBS, and NPR, and on podcasts across political spectrum. In an interview last month with the Cincinnati Inquirer, she emphasized the importance of messaging on immigration policy. Media is so much of the battle, so to speak, on the immigration issue, McLaughlin said. So much of the debate is a public relations debate. It's a PR war. Her portfolio extended beyond immigration to other DHS responsibilities, including Transportation Secretary Administration operations during a government shutdown, Coast Guard drug interdiction efforts in the Caribbean, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency's response to major storms. McLaughlin previously served in the Trump administration working for Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and at the State Department on arms control matters. Some Democrat politicians publicly criticized her during her tenure. McLaughlin, however, continued to receive public praise from President Donald Trump. After a December media interview, Trump described her as the wonderful Trisha McLaughlin, adding, "Trisha really knows her stuff." On social media, at the start of the year, McLaughlin shared a meme reading, "Your boons mean nothing. I've seen what makes you cheer." It is not yet clear what her professional move will be. Next, we have Trade Rep Greer, Tariffs Boosting U.S. Industry by James Morley III. The U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer said Tuesday that the Trump administration may fine-tune how certain tariffs are applied to ease compliance burdens on businesses. At the same time, he made clear the White House intends to keep key metals tariffs in place as part of its strategy to rebuild domestic manufacturing. Speaking to CNBC, Greer said tariff policy may be adjusted for compliance purposes, acknowledging concerns from companies facing increased paperwork and staffing costs. "You may want to sometimes adjust the way some of the tariffs are applied for compliance purposes," he said. "We've heard stories of companies that have had to hire extra people for compliance," Greer continued. "We're not trying to have people do so much bean counting they're not running their company correctly." However, Greer said the administration's tariffs on steel and aluminum will remain, describing them as very successful in strengthening U.S. production. "Clearly, those are going in the right direction," Greer said. "They're going to stay in place. President Donald Trump has centered his economic agenda on tariffs, using import duties to pressure foreign competitors, curb reliance on overseas supply chains, and encourage companies to move production and jobs back to the United States." The administration argues that tariffs safeguard U.S. steel and aluminum producers, industries it considers vital to national security and domestic infrastructure, while also encouraging investment in American factories and broader industrial capacity. Next, we have Labor OIG. $1 billion in COVID benefits vulnerable to fraud by Sandy Fitzgerald. The Labor Department's Office of Inspector General, OIG, has determined that just under $1 billion in COVID-era unemployment benefits has not been used and could be subject to fraud. "My office has warned that absent swift action, U.S. taxpayers risk losing nearly $1 billion in fraudulently obtained benefits, Inspector General Anthony D'Esposito said in a statement. The OIG determined that $720 million in unemployment insurance benefits remain on prepaid debit cards, with another $192 million moved to state unclaimed property offices. This is taxpayer money, and it demands immediate attention, D'Esposito said. We've done the investigative work. We've identified where the money is. There is no excuse for delay and no acceptable outcome other than returning these dollars to the American people. One of the prepaid cards alone holds about $76,000, according to the OIG. Residents in most states can receive unemployment benefits on prepaid debit cards, which do not require a bank account or a submission of financial information to the government. Depending on the state, recipients can also be paid through direct deposit or paper checks. D'Esposito's team urged the Labor Department's Employment and Training Administration to send guidance to states about recovering the funds. Fraud isn't a victimless crime, D'Esposito, a former GOP congressman, said in a statement. Every dollar stolen is a dollar that families don't have for groceries, rent, health care, or gas. When we root out fraud, we protect taxpayers and lower the real cost of living, he added. The findings came after investigators analyzed approximately 6.5 million prepaid cards that were used during the pandemic to pay benefits. The OIG work so far has led to $2.2 billion in recovered funds, charges against 2,300 people, and 1,800 convictions. Last year, the Small Business Administration found that it had disbursed up to $200 billion in potentially fraudulent loans, through its pandemic relief programs. Next, we have Hegseth orders removal of Army advisor linked to Milley by Charlie McCarthy. War Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered the removal of a senior Army public affairs official who previously served under former Joint Chief Chair Mark Milley, according to reports. The Washington Post and the New York Times reported that Hegseth directed Army Secretary Dan Driscoll to fire Army Colonel Dave Butler, a communications officer who has been serving as a strategic advisor and spokesperson for the Army's leadership. Butler ultimately chose to submit retirement paperwork rather than remain in place while his name continued to delay a larger list of Army promotions. According to the Post, Butler's name was among roughly three dozen promotion-eligible Army officers whose advancement has been delayed for months. Officials told the newspaper that Hegseth took issue with Butler's planned promotion to Brigadier General for reasons that remain unclear, and that Butler's retirement was intended to prevent further delays for other officers. In a statement cited by the Post, Driscoll praised Butler's service, but did not address the circumstances behind his departure. We greatly appreciate Colonel Dave Butler's lifetime of service in America's Army and to our nation, Driscoll said. Dave has been an integral part of the Army's transformation efforts. The Times reported, it is unusual for a war secretary to personally intervene in the removal of any Army spokesman, and said Hegseth has made no secret of his animosity towards Milley, a frequent target of President Donald Trump. Milley has faced scrutiny from Trump's allies dating back to the president's first term, and the Post noted Hegseth has already taken administrative actions against him, including suspending his security clearance, revoking his security detail, and ordering a Pentagon investigator general review of his past conduct. Fox News, citing military officials, reported that Butler volunteered to have his name removed from the promotion list if it would help unlock other promotions. The outlet said the list had been delayed for nearly 4 months because Hegseth has concerns about several officers selected by the Army Board, though the secretary reportedly cannot legally remove them. Driscoll reportedly had resisted pressure to remove Butler for months, citing Butler's role in Army modernization efforts and his experience handling major events, including the Army's 250th birthday celebrations and a high-profile military parade in Washington. The reports come as Hegseth continues an effort to overhaul Pentagon leadership, a move supporters say is necessary to restore accountability and refocus the military on readiness rather than politics. Next, we have Vance says U.S. red lines unmet after latest Iran talks. Iran asserted Tuesday that talks in Geneva produced an agreement on guiding principles to avert conflict, but Vice President J.D. Vance countered that Tehran still has not recognized key U.S. red lines. The Omani mediated talks were aimed at averting the possibility of U.S. military intervention to curb Iran's nuclear program. Weeks after the cleric-run state killed thousands of people as it crushed mass demonstrations, Iran's supreme leader had warned earlier in the day that the country had the ability to sink a U.S. warship recently deployed to the region after President Donald Trump alluded to consequences should the two sides fail to strike a deal. Ultimately, we were able to reach broad agreement on a set of guiding principles based on which we will move forward and begin working on the text of a potential agreement, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told state television after Tuesday's talks, which he described as more constructive than the previous round earlier this month. He added that both sides had come up with draft texts for an agreement. The drafts would be exchanged for a date for a third round of talks would be set. In Washington, Vance also appeared to indicate that the United States preferred diplomacy, but painted a more mixed picture. In some ways, it went well. They agreed to meet afterwards, Vance said in the Fox News interview. But in other ways, it was very clear that the president has set some red lines that the Iranians are not willing to actually acknowledge and work through, Vance said. We're going to keep working on it. But of course, the president reserves the ability to say when he thinks the diplomacy has reached its natural end, Vance said. Key gaps. Araghchi also acknowledged that it will take time to narrow the gap between the countries after talking with Trump's friend and roving envoy Steve Witkoff and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Iran, for years, has been seeking relief from sweeping sanctions imposed by the United States, including a U.S.-imposed ban on other countries buying its oil. Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Bazari said the two sides had made good progress, but likewise cautioned much work is left to be done. Washington has ordered two aircraft carriers to the region as it piles on pressure. The first, the U.S. Abraham Lincoln, with nearly 80 aircraft, was positioned about 435 miles from the Iranian coast as of Sunday, satellite images showed. Its location puts it at least puts at least a dozen U.S. F-35s and F-18 fighter jets within striking distance. A second carrier was dispatched over the weekend. A warship is certainly a dangerous weapon. But even more dangerous is the weapon capable of sinking it, Khamenei said in a speech Tuesday. Iran has insisted that talks be limited to the nuclear issue, though Washington has previously pushed for other topics to be discussed, including Tehran's ballistic missiles program and support for armed groups in the region. War games. Iran has also sought to display its military might with its Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, beginning a series of war games Monday in the Straits of Hormuz to prepare for potential security and military threats, state television said. Iranian politicians have repeatedly threatened to block the strait, a strategic route for oil and gas. A previous attempt at diplomacy collapsed last year when Israel launched surprise attacks on Iran in June, beginning a 12-day war that Washington briefly joined to bomb Iranian nuclear sites. The West fears Iran's nuclear program is aimed at making a bomb, which Tehran denies. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian reiterated in an interview published Tuesday, that Tehran was absolutely not seeking nuclear weapons. If anyone wants to verify this, we are open to such verification to take place, he said. Ali Fethullah Najad, director of the Berlin-based Center for Middle East and Global Order, said Iran was faced with an existential dilemma. Giving in to U.S. demands could bring sanctions relief that it would desperately need to stabilize the regime and fund its repressive apparatus, he told the AFP. However, any significant concessions on nuclear, ballistic missile, and regional proxies issues would sensitively undermine its ideological and military standing. Next, we have DHS Blasts Report on Nome, Coast Guard Tensions, by Charlie McCarthy. The Department of Homeland Security rejected an NBC News report claiming Secretary Kristi Noem has a strained relationship with Coast Guard officials. NBC News cited unnamed current and former officials reported that tensions have emerged between Noem and senior Coast Guard leaders over her focus on immigration enforcement and the use of Coast Guard aircraft for deportation flights. The outlet reported that some officials were frustrated by what they described as shifting priorities within the service. The entire premise of your story is incorrect, and these attacks are nothing more than a politicized deep state effort to undermine President Trump's immigration and enforcement agenda and distract from the historic successes that the Department of Homeland Security and the Coast Guard have achieved since he returned to office, a DHS spokesperson told NBC in response to the report. The NBC News report centered in part on a February 2025 search and rescue mission for a missing Coast Guardsman in the Pacific. The outlet reported that Noem verbally instructed leaders to ensure a C-30 aircraft remained available for deportation flights tied to what it described as the administration's alien expulsion operations. DHS denied that the aircraft was diverted away from the search, stating the C-30 never left the search and that there is no documentation showing it was pulled from the mission. The aircraft supported the search from February 4th through the 8th out of El Salvador and then returned to San Diego on February 9th, the day after the search was suspended, a DHS spokesperson said in an email to Newsmax. that anybody would try to politicize this mission in tragic loss of life just to smear a public official for political gain, especially while hiding behind a veil of anonymity, is shameful and grotesque. NBC also highlighted a report dispute involving NOM's senior advisor, Corey Lewandowski, and Coast Guard flight staff over personal items left on a government aircraft. DHS did not directly address that allegation in NBC's report, but rejected broader claims of misconduct and resource misuse. The Wall Street Journal on February 12th described internal tensions at DHS tied to NOM's push to implement President Donald Trump's mass deportation agenda. The Journal noted that NOM and Lewandowski have taken a high-profile approach to immigration enforcement, sometimes clashing with career officials over messaging, travel, and spending priorities. Still, Trump has publicly defended NOM. "I think she's done a very good job," Trump told NBC News earlier this month, crediting her with helping secure the border and saying she may have a public relations challenge, but remains effective. The Journal also reported that despite criticism from some Democrats and private concerns with the administration, Trump has resisted calls to remove NOM, stating he has full confidence in her leadership. Under NOM, DHS has dramatically expanded deportation operations and redirected resources toward immigration enforcement, a central pillar of Trump's second-term agenda. Admiral Kevin Lunday, commandant of the Coast Guard, issued a statement that was sent to Newsmax. "Under Secretary Noem's leadership, the Coast Guard has delivered record results in value for the American people over the past year," Lunday said. "The men and women of the Coast Guard take great pride in that. The Coast Guard is implementing Secretary Noem's direction through Force Design 2028 to renew the service to become more agile, capable, and responsive to deliver greater value to the nation. As a reflection of the Secretary's strong advocacy and support for the Coast Guard and its workforce, the service has seen its greatest recruiting success in over 30 years. Supporters argue that critics inside the bureaucracy are resistant to change and uncomfortable with a more aggressive, broader security posture. DHS officials maintain that the Coast Guard remains mission-ready and that suggestions of a crisis in morale or leadership are politically motivated. Next, we have Trump. "Potomac spill, a radical left environmental hazard." President Donald Trump on Tuesday urged Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. leaders to act immediately to address a massive sewer spill fouling the Potomac River, placing public pressure on local officials while the environmental cleanup continues. In a Truth Social post, Trump wrote that officials must get to work immediately and suggests that if they can't do it, the job, they should call me and ask politely to get it fixed. He asserted that the federal government is not at all involved in what has taken place, but we can fix it, warning the situation, which he called a radical left-caused environmental hazard, would only get worse. The spill began on January 19th, when a 72-inch sewer line known as the Potomac Interceptor collapsed near the Clara Barton Parkway in Montgomery County, Maryland, sending hundreds of millions of gallons of raw sewage into the river. An incident described by local environmental groups as one of the largest in U.S. history. Local authorities estimated the rupture line has discharged roughly 243 million gallons of wastewater so far, and ongoing repair work could take months to complete. In his post, Trump blamed Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C., who are responsible for the massive sewage spill, and called on the area's governors and the U.S. Capitol's mayor to take immediate action. He also referenced the ongoing federal government funding impasse, claiming that even if federal help were sought, work would require true patriots because many are not working right now. Public health and state agencies have issued warnings for people and pets to avoid contact with contaminated water, and recreational activities such as fishing, swimming, and boating have been restricted in affected river stretches due to high levels of bacteria. Next, we have Bowens to Newsmax. Transgenderism symptom in rise of violent attacks, by Newsmax Wires. Author Dr. Jennifer Bowens told Newsmax on Tuesday that she believes transgender identity can be a symptom of deeper psychological conditions that are not being properly addressed in a growing number of shootings involving individuals who identify as transgender. Appearing on Carl Higbee Frontline, Bowens reacted to the recent case of Robert Dorgan, who authorities said opened fire at a Rhode Island ice rink before taking his own life. Investigators have said Dorgan had previously undergone a gender-related medical procedure and had interacted with medical and mental health professionals. "What we're looking at here is a travesty," she said. "This person had interaction with the medical and psychological community, obviously because he had some kind of gender procedure. That would have been a great opportunity for a good assessment to really look at what his underlying conditions are, rather than go down a path that led him to further disconnect from his identity, from his body," Bowens said. Bowens called the incident such a sad case, adding, "You have not just the loss of Mr. Dugan, but you have other people, the victims, who have lost lives. And this is becoming increasingly problematic." Host Carl Higbee asked whether transgenderism is possibly a symptom here. "I believe so, because you have all of these other comorbidities that are being addressed in the clinical community," Bowens said. "And a lot of times you have clinicians who, the first sniff of a transgender identity, they go down the path of gender-affirming care rather than addressing the real issues. This person obviously had real issues. And that's a sad case, because the field didn't help. They actually harmed," she said. She continued. "Several high-profile shootings in recent years have involved perpetrators who identified as transgender or non-binary. In 2018, Snochia Mosley, who identified as transgender, finally fatally shot 3 people at a Rite Aid distribution center in Maryland before killing herself. That same year, Alec McKinley, a student who identified as male after transitioning, was one of 2 students responsible for the STEM school Highlands Ranch shooting in Colorado. More recently, Aiden Hale, also known as Audrey Hale, carried out the 2023 attack at the Covenant School in Nashville, Tennessee, killing 6 people. Other cases frequently cited in public debate include Jesse Van Rootsteller and Robert Westman, whose alleged involvement in violent incidents has drawn scrutiny online because of reported transgender identification. Law enforcement officials have not concluded that the gender identity itself was a casual factor in these crimes, Bowman's author of Embracing God's Design, Addressing the Spiritual and Psychological Crisis Behind Transgender Identity, said the focus should be on the underlying mental health conditions. We need to be looking at what the root cause of these shootings, what's the root causes of these shootings, because they seem to be on the rise, she said. Of course, they're connected to other mental health conditions, she said. Next, we have Steve Bannon, close to Epstein, backed Trump removal, by Newsmax Newswires. Newly released Justice Department files shed fresh light on former Donald Trump strategist Steve Bannon's private communications with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The files revealed discussions about invoking the 25th Amendment to remove then-President Trump in efforts by Bannon to advise Epstein as Epstein faced renewed legal scrutiny. The documents, which include text messages and emails from late 2017 through Epstein's arrest in July 2019, show that Bannon, a prominent figure in the MAGA movement and former White House chief strategist, maintained a close and at times supportive relationship with Epstein. The files also show that the relationship continued long after Epstein's 2008 conviction for soliciting a minor for prostitution. One of the most explosive exchanges occurred in a text conversation beginning on New Year's Eve 2018, shortly after Democrats regained control of the House of Representatives. According to messages, Bannon said that the White House, WH, widely understood to mean the White House, had zero plan to punch back amid mounting political pressure. Epstein responded, referring to Trump, "He is really borderline. Not sure what he may do." Bannon replied, "I think it's beyond borderline. 25th Amendment," referring to the constitutional provision that allows the vice president and a majority of the cabinet to remove a president deemed unfit for office. In another part of the exchange, Bannon wrote that, "We really need an intervention regarding Trump." The disclosure of those texts has triggered backlash from some conservatives. Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn wrote on X that if Bannon and Epstein were behind it, Bannon needs to be brought in for questioning. Even former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, echoed those concerns, writing that there was no excuse for having such a friendly relationship with Epstein post-conviction 2018 to 2019, none. Bannon has not publicly addressed the 25th Amendment texts in detail, but has deferred his broader communications with Epstein as part of a documentary project. In a statement to the New York Times, Bannon said, "I am a filmmaker, a TV host with decades of experience interviewing controversial figures. That's the only lens through which these private communications should be viewed. A documentary filmmaker working over a period of time to secure 50 hours of interviews from a reclusive subject." The files, however, depict a close relationship that went beyond arranging interviews. After meeting in late 2017, reportedly introduced by author Michael Wolff, who later credited Bannon for a key source for his explosive 2018 book, Fire and Fury, the two men developed what Epstein described as an associate as a friendship. "We have become friends," Epstein wrote in February 2018. Wolf's Fire and Flurry, which portrayed a chaotic White House and raised questions about Trump's fitness for office, fueled early public discussions about whether the 25th Amendment could be invoked. Bannon was widely reported to have been a central source for the book behind the scenes accounts and later quietly helped fuel calls for Trump's removal. as Epstein's legal exposure intensified in early 2019 following great investigative reporting by the Miami Herald, the tone of Bannon's messages shifted toward crisis management. In April 2019, Bannon texted Epstein, "First we need to push back on the lies, then crush the pedo-trafficking narrative, then rebuild your image as philanthropist." In another message, Bannon emphasized the reputational stakes. "We must counter a rapist who traffics in female children to be raped by world's most powerful, richest men. That can't be redeemed." When news broke in February 2019 that federal prosecutors were reviewing and handling the handling of Epstein's 2008 plea deal, Epstein asked Bannon whether he should publicly respond. Bannon reacted bluntly, "Have you lost your effing mind?" He acted, "The moment you say anything, this is global story number one." The documents show Bannon advising Epstein on legal and public relations strategy, including recommending attorneys. At one point, Bannon suggested hiring William A. Burke and Alex Spiro, referring to them as "my boys." Both lawyers have said they did not represent Epstein. Bannon also arranged what he described as media training. In one April 2019 text, he wrote, "Friday afternoon media training at your place. Two camera shoot, my crew, so totally confidential." Epstein replied that the session would be trial by fire. The two men's exchanges included logistical discussions about travel and meeting at Epstein's Manhattan townhouse and Paris apartment. In March 2019, Bannon texted from Rome, "Is it possible to get your plane here to collect me?" Epstein responded that the plane was unavailable but offered to pay for a charter flight. Days later, Bannon wrote, "I'm staying with you tonight." Epstein replied, "Yes, stay." Epstein also offered to cover Bannon's medical expenses and sent him and his son Apple Watches, according to the files. Bannon's spokesman has said that he did not fly on Epstein's jet or use his doctor. In email correspondence cited in the release, Epstein commented to an associate about Bannon's financial backers, "Someone has to fund this nonsense," referring to Bannon's alliances with Chinese billionaire Guwenji. Despite Epstein's growing legal jeopardy, the communications continued until July 2019. The two men had planned to meet shortly after Epstein's return from Paris. Instead, he was arrested upon landing in New Jersey. "All canceled," Epstein texts Bannon. It was his final message to him. The newly disclosed messages place Bannon at the center of two volatile narratives from the Trump era: internal discussions about the president's fitness for office and the web of relationships surrounding Epstein. While Bannon maintains that his interactions were journalistic in nature, the tone and substance of the exchanges suggest a far more collaborative relationship, one that now faces renewed scrutiny. Next, we have Bayer agrees to $7.25 billion Roundup cancer settlement. Agrochemical maker Bayer and attorneys for cancer patients announced a proposed $7.25 billion settlement Tuesday and resolved thousands of U.S. lawsuits alleging the company failed to warn people that its popular weed killer Roundup could cause cancer. The proposed settlement comes as the U.S. Supreme Court is preparing to hear arguments in April on Bayer's assertion that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency approval of Roundup without cancer warning should invalidate claims filed in state court. That case would not be affected by the proposed settlement, but the settlement would eliminate some of the risk from an eventual Supreme Court ruling. Patients would be assured of receiving settlement money even if the Supreme Court rules in Bayer's favor, and Bayer would be protected from potentially larger costs if the High Court rules against it. Germany-based Bayer, which acquired Roundup maker Monsanto in 2018, disputes the assertion that Roundup's key ingredient, glyphosate, can cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But the company has warned that mounting legal costs are threatening its ability to continue selling the product in the U.S. agricultural markets. Litigation uncertainty has plagued the company for many years, and this settlement gives the company a road to closure, Bayer CEO Bill Anderson said Tuesday. The proposed settlement was filed in St. Louis Circuit Court in Missouri, home of Bayer's North America Crops Science Division, and the state where many of the lawsuits have been brought. The settlement still needs the court's approval. More than 125,000 plaintiffs have lodged legal claims over Roundup since 2015, according to the settlement documents. Few have gone to jurors, with 13 verdicts for Bayer and 11 for plaintiffs, including a $2.1 billion award by a Georgia jury last year. Others already had been resolved through separate settlements, including two recent ones that would take care of about 77,000 of the claims. The newly proposed nationwide settlement is designed to address most of the remaining lawsuits, as well as any additional cases brought in the coming years by people who were exposed to Roundup before Tuesday. If too many plaintiffs opt out of the proposed settlement, Bayer said it reserves the right to cancel it. But Bayer did not specify how many opt-outs would have to occur. The deal calls for Bayer to make annual payments into a special fund for up to 21 years, totaling as much as $7.25 billion. The amount of money paid out to individuals would vary depending on how they use Roundup, how old they were when diagnosed, and the severity of their non-Hodgkin lymphoma. An agricultural, industrial, and turf worker exposed at length to Roundup would receive an average of $165,000 if diagnosed with an aggressive form of the illness, while younger than age 60, according to the proposed settlement. Meanwhile, a residential Roundup user diagnosed between the ages of 60 and 77 with aggressive form of illness would receive an average of $20,000. No settlement can erase a diagnosis, but this agreement is designed to ensure that both today and tomorrow's patients have access to meaningful compensation, said attorney Christopher Seeger, who would represent current claimants under the settlement. Well, that concludes today's reading of Newsmax on the Talk Information Center on this Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. I hope you enjoyed today's reading, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.